Hi guys, welcome back to the Real Fix podcast, your fix of real life stories. I'm Hattie Bishop, I'm a journalist and I help people share their stories with the national newspapers and magazines. Each week I'm joined by my wonderful colleagues from the newsroom who will introduce you to some incredible people telling their remarkable stories and all in their very own words. So, this is episode 8. We hope you like it and are as moved by our interviewee stories as we have been. We really do love hearing what you think of the podcast, so please do leave us a review and hit subscribe while you're there. This week, we'll be hearing from the newlyweds who had just vowed till death do us part. But little did they know, death nearly came sooner than they were banking on when the groom plummeted through a staircase on their wedding night. He was left in a coma, and when he eventually woke, he couldn't even remember tying the knot.
Anybody mention the wedding, that's immediately what I think of, is the fall. I don't think of the special day we had.
We also speak to a widow who made the selfless decision to donate her husband's organs after he passed away in a tragic accident. Amazingly, she went on to become firm friends with the man who got his kidney, and when it failed, she gave him one of her own. Now, both kidneys sit side by side, much to the delight of her son.
Peyton would reach over and put his hand on his stomach. He said, "My dad's in there?" And Jeff said, "Yes." You know, he goes, "I'm going to keep him as long as I can."
But first, we speak to a woman whose heavily pregnant daughter was shot and killed by her ruthless boyfriend. When Audrey didn't turn up to a family gathering, her mum Patty started to worry. She rushed over to her home, but nothing could have prepared her for what she found. Audrey had been shot in the face by her boyfriend Javier, who then fled the scene with their son Elias, prompting a police chase and frantic shootout. Audrey survived long enough to give birth to baby Josiah, who later died in Patty's arms. The devoted grandmother from California in the USA is now raising surviving son Elias and keeping Josiah's memory alive for the little boy. She joined our reporter, Lucy Bryant, to talk through what happened on that fateful day.
I just told her he was never going to change. He was never going to change for her to stop wasting her time. Because she was just like obsessed with him. Because I even went to her one day and I told her, somebody told me that he had another girl in her car because she was always lending him her car. He didn't have a car of his own. And somebody told me that he was in there with a girl in Audrey's car. That was the same baby mama. She was in Audrey's car and I told Audrey. So Audrey went and called him up and told him, "What is my mom talking about?" He denied it. He said they're all lies. And she always believed him. She always believed him. All she wanted was him to be a father to the kids and to go to work and come home. American dream, you know, go to work 9 to 5 and, you know, but he wasn't that kind of guy. And I told her that. He will never change.
And then obviously we come to the incident in April 2020 and your family were getting together to celebrate Easter. And by this time, Audrey was 9 months gone and sort of due any day now. Your husband, Jimmy, had gone over to see George, who was Javier's dad. And when you received a very concerned call from him, do you mind telling us a bit about what he said?
Jimmy called me and he told me, "Audrey's fighting. Can you please come pick up Elias?" he said. And I said, "No, I'm not going to pick up Elias. Tell her to go home." So then he hung up and he went and told her to go home. And then he called me back and he goes, "I told her 3 times to go home already. They're fighting." That was nothing new because they were always arguing. She's always had bruises on her arms. But she was pregnant, so I didn't think that he would, you know, knock her around. I didn't think nothing, that, you know, I thought she was safe. So then I told Jimmy to come to my house and meet my other daughter, Arlene, here to pick up the food. We had barbecued. So he came over here. I guess that was, what, maybe 20 minutes at the most. He went back, and George was outside, and he said there was gunshots. And Javier locked me out. He took the baby and left in Audrey's car, and I heard gunshots. He said he didn't have the key, so Jimmy opened the door to go in there. Jimmy told me that he went in there, and he seen Audrey, that she was already gone. But in between that time, when he, I guess he, after he seen her, he called me. At that time, I didn't know he seen her, that she was gone. He just told me that it's bad, you need to get over here. And then I heard him telling George, why didn't you call the ambulance? And then my daughter, Brooke, heard ambulance. She goes, let's go. We just ran out of the house. It took us exactly like maybe 9 minutes to get to from our town, little town, Bakersfield, to Lamont. And when I went over there, Jimmy stopped me and he said, it's bad. And I walked in and I told Audrey, I thought maybe he just, I don't know, that he just, I was going to find her with black eyes or something. And I walked in and I go, Audrey, let's go. I go, you continue your despite later on. Let's go. Let's get out of here. So I walked in and she's not moving and I'm looking at her and I said, Audrey, come on. And I look closer. She wasn't moving. And then I seen a little hole in her cheek with blood coming out of it, and her eyes were open and her hands were on her legs. And I said, what did he do to you? I thought he just knocked, you know, she was unconscious, that he just knocked her out. And as I looked closer, I seen that she wasn't moving. And that's when I just started screaming and I ran out the door and I tried to call. I told Brooke, I yelled out the screen. I said, he shot her. And then my daughter came running in, what? Screaming. We were screaming in the middle of the street. She came running in and I ran out. I was praying. And then the cops didn't come for at least 20 minutes. They took a long time because of the COVID. And two girls from this block, they heard all the commotion. They came in and they dragged her off the couch and put her on the floor. And they were doing CPR until the ambulance got there. So they were trying to save the baby. And then the ambulance finally came and took her, and the baby was, he never breathed on his own, but he was on a breathing tube for 3 days. And he had hope. We were hoping that he would survive, that she would, you know, we would leave something from her, you know, the baby. But he only lasted 3 days, and we took the machine off because he was brain dead.
So Javier left with Elias, so he's... in effect kidnapped, obviously, your grandson. Yes. Having shot your daughter, he then kidnaps him, takes him away, and obviously then he's on Amber Alert with the police. What did that mean? Were they sort of actively looking for him, making sure that they tracked it? Did they know that it was him that had fired the gun at your daughter?
Oh, yes, they knew right away. We told them that he had shot her. And I guess they knew that after they checked his lengthy record, they knew him already, and they were looking for him right away, and they were looking for the baby. But in the time, the ambulance, we followed me and my daughter, Brooke, and Arlene was front in the front car. We followed the ambulance to the hospital. And then the cop was there, and he was keeping us updated on what was going on with Elias. They haven't found him. They didn't find him. And then finally we got the call that he had dropped her off at one of his sister's house. So Elias was safe.
Did you worry in that time that he wouldn't be? Did you think, oh my God,
yes.
I've just lost my daughter. I've just realized that she's dead and she's been murdered, and now I might lose my grandson as well. Did that go through your head? Or?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. It sure did. I thought for sure. Even if the other two girls were there, thank God I didn't let him go that day with her, because he would have did them all. He would have killed them all. He would have killed them all. He was out. He had his mind made up. I don't know. And then they even found a gun in her house when the cops were searching for Elias. They thought maybe he went and hid himself at Audrey's house. They found a gun in there that was dismantled. It was all taken apart. So I figured maybe he killed somebody. He killed somebody and he knew he was going to go to jail or something. And that he took Audrey with him because of that gun that they found. But they never came to nothing, because unless they just stopped investigating, I don't know. But that's why I thought he killed her. A bunch of stuff was going through my head. Why? I don't understand it. I know that he was abusive, because when she was pregnant, she always had bruises. He always kicked her when she was pregnant, threw her on the ground. I don't know. We'll never know. I guess only she knows.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just devastating. And was it then... her unborn baby that unfortunately, obviously, you had to make the heartbreaking decision to turn off his life support.
Yes, on the 15th. On the 15th.
Bless you. The medics had performed an emergency C-section once Audrey had already been pronounced dead, and at that point were able to save little Josiah. When he was sort of hooked up on to life support and covered in wires, did you have hope that he might make it through, or did you always sort of know at that point that it was too late for him?
No, yes, I had hope. I had a lot of hope that he would make it and that she would live through him. And it was so sad that he didn't, because I so wanted him to make it. I wanted him to be here with us. And when we found out that there was no hope, I didn't really even want to let go then. But I had hope. I did have hope until the doctor told me that he was suffering. The machines were making him breathe for him, and I should let him go. I didn't want to let him go.
Bless you.
But I got to hold him when he took his last breath. And I knew that his mom was there to take him, because I felt her. And when he took the last breath, I told him to go with his mom. I said, go ahead and go with your mom. She needs you. She's waiting for you. And I felt him when he took his last breath. I just knew she was waiting for him.
And was it yourself who named him? I know you chose to name him Josiah. Was that a decision of yours, or was that something that you'd spoken about with your daughter before she'd passed?
Yes, because she had told me more names. She was like, what's a good name? Because she was thinking of Adrian. She liked that name, Adrian. But then I was reading the Bible that day. When she called me, I happened to be reading the Bible, and it was open. So I looked down when she said that, and there was a bunch of names right there. So I just started naming some off. And then that one, Josiah, stuck with her. She goes, I really like that one. So she said that she was going to name him Josiah.
That must have been really special for you in all of that grief to actually know that she was going, he was going to be with his mother. And that, was that a comfort for you?
Yes, it was. And it was really crazy, because I always she would ask me to watch Elias for her. And I told her, I go, no, you got to keep one with you. I always told her that. I don't know. It was just something within me. Maybe she was safer with him, because maybe Javier wouldn't do nothing. I was thinking he wouldn't do nothing in front of the kid and the baby. You know, but I always made her keep one with her, you know, the Elias, because that was his son, and I thought he wouldn't do anything in front of him. And then it was crazy to me the way when she passed, she took one with her. She didn't go alone. She still had one with her.
That's really special, even though it's obviously completely devastating. And in the early hours of the morning, Javier was located on a highway. A SWAT team responded and there was a lot of gunfire. And actually, Javier was declared dead at the scene at sort of 4 a.m. in the morning. Obviously, luckily by that point, Elias, who had been taken with Javier, was recovered safe and sound. When did you find out that Elias was safe and that you could be reunited again?
I found out that night at the hospital, maybe about 11:30 at night, but I think maybe 11:30 we were at the hospital waiting for the baby to find out what's going on, with them to tell us that Audrey was deceased, even though I seen her and I knew in my heart. I was still hoping, there was still hope that they would bring her back, you know, that she would come back to life. So when we were out there waiting, the officer came and told me that Elias was safely with Javier's sister. And we didn't find out about the cops getting Javier until I got home. Till after we left the hospital, they made us leave the hospital because of COVID. They were making a big thing that we couldn't be out there. So they made us leave. I didn't even get to see Audrey that night. I didn't get to see her until she went to the funeral home because of COVID. And that was really hard. And then when we came home, somebody told me to look on Facebook, and we heard every minute when the cops were firing back and everything back, you know, all the shots were coming. back and forth, and he was firing back. It was over 500 shots, I heard. And he was under the car. I heard he was under the car when they shot, you know, when he was coming out. I think he did that on purpose, maybe. Straight, that's why he was fighting. That's why he was a coward. He wanted them to shoot him instead of going to jail to pay for what he did. Yeah. He made the cop shoot him. He was firing back.
It's just so unfair that obviously he took Audrey with him in that horrible situation, and so unbelievably unfair. Obviously, little Elias was left without either of his parents, but you battled to get care of him and now look after him full time. What does he know about what happened to his mummy and what his daddy did and what have you?
See, when I got him back at first, when they took him to child, you know, the foster care, they took him in for 2 days. I didn't get to see him for 2 days. It was devastating because I knew that he was lost without her. I knew that he was going hysterical without her. He was too close to her, too close. I'm telling you, that kid was, they was never apart from her. He was never apart from Audrey. And so those 2 days he was in foster care, I didn't know how he was taking it. It was really hard. Finally, they released him to me. And when he did come, matter of fact, last night when we were having dinner, every day he says, "Mama, Papa," and then he says, "Mama, ouch," and then he starts kicking the floor. He starts kicking the air. "Mama, ouch." You know, every day he keeps telling us the same story. And his sister Lucy, my granddaughter, she goes, "I wonder if he's seen, because he's always saying the same thing. I go, he just remembers him hurting her all the time, because they were always fighting. I don't know, but he's every day. It's like, it's torment, because that little boy, he does not forget her. He does not, like, he looks at the picture I have, the Last Supper, because I told him his mama is with Jesus. And he looks at the picture, he goes, "Mama?" And he points to the picture. He just, all day long, he's just, "Mama?" You know, he's always asking.
That must be really hard. Yeah, really hard for you, because obviously you miss her too, and you've got to try and be strong for him and what have you. And did you tell him about his little brother? Because obviously he probably knew that he had a sibling on the way. How did you explain that?
Yes, Lucy was telling him, "Mama's with Josiah," she tells him. She goes, "You know you have a brother." She tells him, "You have a brother in heaven. He's always crying. He's always crying. He's always crying." And he said, "Mama, Papa." But for the most part, he's doing well.
That's really good to hear. You must all miss Audrey and Josiah every day. What will you and Elias do to keep their memories alive?
Well, I keep her picture up, and then we go to the cemetery quite a bit. Have picnics out there with her, celebrating her birthday. You know, we'll be doing all that. We won't let her memory die. I want to find a way where we can make domestic violence awareness. I want to look into that to see how we can do that. And we are planning to, every year on the anniversary of April 12th, she liked to drive. Audrey loved to cruise. She's always taking her kids for a ride. She loved to be in her car. So we're going to do a memory cruise a few months before the anniversary of what had happened. And we're going to get a cruise together, like we did on the day of her funeral. We had a cruise, her last cruise, because she loved to cruise and listen to her oldies.
Oh, that would be amazing to make it. Obviously, a horrible day into something positive, especially for Elias, just to remember the good things and not the heartbreaking way in which she was taken from you all.
That's one way. You know, we can't let her die in vain. I have to keep domestic violence awareness to these girls, because there's a lot of girls out there that are like that. They think that they need a man to make them whole, when that's not the case, you know? They would stay with a man when they're hitting them, and hide it, because there was a lot going on at the last days that she was hiding. the color of her, she was drained. She lost that. She lost everything inside of her. She used to be a happy-go-lucky girl, the life of the party. And the last few months of her life, I can show you her picture that I took on her, that we took of me and her on her birthday 2 weeks before she passed. You could see the darkness in her face, the light, the smile, everything was gone. He took it out of her. He robbed her of her soul. I don't know it's how to even explain it. She was just, her face was just, that joy was gone. Like something on her mind was, I don't know how to explain it. She lost that light in her. This last picture that she took before she passed, that we had, the selfie that we took, you can just see it. And I don't know how girls can let a man have so much power over them. Once they hit you, you know, that's, forget it, just leave. Once they hit you and belittle you, call you names, you know, they have to believe in you, have more self-worth. And that's what her sisters always used to try to tell her. You are way better than that. You don't need to be putting up with somebody that treats you like that.
No, absolutely. And, well, you obviously have so much love for Audrey, Elias, and little Josiah, and I'm so sorry for you that you've had to lose such a huge part of your life and of Elias's life. I'm sure he has a wonderful role model in yourself to look up to growing up now.
Yes, and the other two girls that I got automatically, I just became a mother overnight with three kids, and I don't know what I would do without them, because that's what's left of her.
Such a tragic story there. We can't thank Patty enough for sharing it with us. Later on in this episode, we'll speak to the woman who donated her late husband's kidney to a stranger and then gave him one of hers too.
My kidney wouldn't fit anywhere except beside Brian's kidney. So Brian's kidney is still there, it's just not working. But my kidney, the only place it would fit was right beside it.
But next, we're going to speak to Chris and Avril from West Lothian in Scotland, UK. They had just got married, but the happiest day of their lives soon turned into the worst. Chris plummeted 12 feet through a banister while making his way up to the honeymoon suite, smashing his skull, back and shoulder, and damaging his heart and lungs. Newlywed Avril watched the horror unfold and held him in her arms, fearing the worst. The couple join our reporter, Laura Elvin, to tell us more.
We decided that it would be nice just to go to the reception area and just have a wee glass before going to bed. And we're walking up and I says, can we take all this to the reception? And the porter says, no, it needs to go upstairs. The porter says, I'll help Chris. You just go on to the reception. They went ahead of us, which you're talking only like 30 seconds in front of us, and we were just walking around to the reception, and the next thing I know, the porter's running like so fast and just screamed at us, shouting, he's fallen, I'm going to go and get an ambulance. And at that point, we knew it was serious, but I didn't actually realise it was Chris.
We had gifts there to take upstairs. The porter ran up just in front of me to open the door. And as I was going up, I got up towards the top of the stair and I tripped. And there was a gap in the banister, which unfortunately I tripped up and I could see the gap coming towards me. And because I had things in my hands, I couldn't stop myself from falling. So I just remember falling towards the gap and thinking, oh dear, this is going to be sore. And from there, I don't really remember very much.
I was first on the scene and Chris was actually trying to lift himself up. He was so delusional. I was holding his head to try and stop the blood. And I just kept on saying to him, stay with me, stay with me. It was unbelievable. It was so surreal. It was like holding him and just thinking, this can't be, you know, this is my wedding day. This doesn't happen. I just kept on holding his hand. I had my hand under his head and I was holding his hand. And I just kept on saying to him, stay with me, because he was in and out of consciousness. My whole attention was on Chris. And when I looked up, the next thing I noticed, there was police everywhere and ambulance. And they were saying, right, we need to get him to hospital. I remember sitting at the post saying, right, I need to go upstairs, get changed, I'm going to the hospital. And I started walking up the stairs and he stopped me and he said, you can't. He went, this is a crime scene. And I was like, oh my goodness. It's like, I can't go to a hospital like this. And he says, you're not allowed in. This is a crime scene. Which is straight away, I was thinking, a crime scene? Do you think I pushed him off? Do you know? It was, do you know, that way, it was an out-of-body experience, if you know what I mean, because it was the happiest day of my life to suddenly just, it was absolutely shattering. I remember seeing his mum as well. She was just constantly praying, which was upsetting to see. She was saying, no, take me, don't take my son. When we got to the hospital, basically he was rushed in front of us and we were sitting in the A&E in my wedding dress, which was... yeah, it was unreal. It's like something you read out in a magazine. But we were thinking the worst, me, cracked ribs, broken shoulder. And the doctors turned around to us and says, no, he says, no, he's going to be in for quite a while. He says, you won't be going your honeymoon. And I was just like, what? No, you're kidding.
And how did you feel, Avril, when, you know, you saw him in this state? Supposed to be the sort of happiest day of your life. How did you feel?
Well, see, at that point, it was like, this can't be real. Do you know? It was like an out-of-body experience, if you know what I mean. I just thought, this is our wedding day. Surely, no, this is just, this can't be happening. It wasn't until the ambulance came and they were working on him that I was actually thinking to myself, what's just happened? Do you know, this is our wedding night. This can't be. I'm talking to her and she's looking at me, the nurse, charge nurse, and she was telling me how ill Chris was. And I'm like, yeah, but he's chatting to us. And she says, the best way to describe this, the fall that Chris has had, the 12 foot, it's like being in a car accident. So you actually don't know the severity of his injuries for the next 24 hours because all the swelling and everything to the organs.
Yeah, I think you told us that he'd fractured his skull, he'd broken his back. I think he had a fractured and dislocated shoulder, didn't he? A broken hand.
Yeah, and the bleed on the brain. So, very worrying. And I was, like, in a wee bit of denial with the nurse, and she actually looked at me, she started crying. And she said, you know, the next 24 hours is critical because it is very serious. And she prepared me for the next time seeing him, that he would be in a induced coma. But I kept on thinking, no, I'm just speaking to him down in A&E. And the next time I did see him, he was in an induced coma.
So you've just had the best day of your life, and here you are looking at your husband in a coma, sitting next to him, I guess, willing for him to wake up. I mean, I can't imagine what that must have felt like.
Oh, it was absolutely horrendous. It was a complete, like, for the 10 days that he was in the coma, it was just a roller coaster. I've not prayed so much in my life because I just thought I was lost. I just kept on, like, holding his hand, and I was talking to him, and I'm quite spiritual, so I was asking for the angels and speaking to God, and you know, just, like, pull through. Because we've got a wee boy as well. It's like, Alex needs you to pull through for all of us.
And I think it was 2 weeks he was in the coma, is that correct?
10 days.
10 days. So he's in the coma for 10 days, and you're sat there by his bed, sort of willing for him to wake up. And he does eventually, and that must have been an extraordinary moment for both of you.
I was there every time that they were trying to bring him back out, but his lungs weren't strong enough and he couldn't breathe on his own, so they had to just put him straight back into the coma again. That was really, that wasn't nice seeing, because I've got that wee bit hope that he's actually, right, okay, he's going to come through now. And then they were like, no, it's not strong enough, and just put him straight back under. So when he did get the tube out, he was very, very delusional, didn't know where he was, confused, very confused, yeah. And didn't remember, I said, when we did actually go up to get, the minute he got, came out of the coma, they moved him then to the high dependency unit. And when we got you into the high dependency unit, he was very confused. And that's when I said to him, do you know we're married? And he didn't know that we were married. So, yeah. But also, when he was coming round, I was singing our first song, and he sang, he was trying to sing it with me. That was a lovely moment.
And what was it like to hear that he didn't remember, you know, such an important day of your life, you didn't remember that you were his wife? What was that like?
Yeah, it was really upsetting. Both myself and his mum cried at that. I was so happy that he was through and he's awake, but then we're scared to just the extent of his brain injury, because there was that droop to his left-hand side, couldn't speak properly, he was so... But then as time got on, we could see, you know, the old Chris coming back, although he's never been 100% since.
And Chris, how did you feel when you first came round and realised what was going on and then realised that you'd got married and couldn't remember it?
It was very confusing. I just remember hearing Avril saying to me about the angels, and I was gradually coming to, and just carried on about the angels and all this. And I just remember thinking, would you please be quiet about these angels? What is going on? But then, when I woke up, very, very confused. Didn't really know where I was, what was going on. And Avril had said, do you realise you're in hospital? And then, obviously, she told me that we'd got married. Because what I wasn't sure was, had it happened before the wedding? Had it happened after? I didn't know. But 3 days, I think, before I actually started to realise properly what was going on around me.
Yeah. And have you recovered that memory for your wedding, Chris? Or as far as you're concerned, do you guys still have to get married still?
Well, I suppose there's two parts to that. I do remember the wedding, I'm glad to say. It did come back to me. I remember it was a lovely day. It was fantastic. And I pretty much remember, I'd say, everything right up until I tripped. After that, I don't remember anything. That did come back. But what Avril did, which was fantastic. Basically, she organised a surprise birthday for my 50th, and halfway through, next thing I know, down comes the registrar everything to renew our vows. So that's very special.
It was just nice to have that memory, because although we had a lovely day on our wedding day, and we've got the memory, Chris was asleep for most of it. He didn't experience what myself, his mum and dad, his sister, his son, all of us were going through. And anybody mentioned the wedding, that's immediately what I think of, is the fall. I don't think of the special day we had, so I thought it was important that we would renew our wedding vows. It was lovely.
And Chris, you were initially told by the medics that it would maybe take you 18 months to recover, but after about 4 weeks you were back with your family at home, which is fantastic, and I gather you're doing really well. I guess just one last thing I wanted to ask you both really was, how did what happened impact your relationship, that side of things?
We have had it. We're great now, but it was very difficult at times. So with a brain injury, like short-temperedness, and Chris had changed at that point. He's got better now.
Yeah, that was one of the things. I didn't really realise at the time until a bit later on, but I tended to be angry a lot more than I'd ever been. And that was... Because I'm not usually an angry person as such, you know, and it sort of surprised me. And it wasn't until one point a very big argument, and I thought, this isn't right. And I actually sought help from somebody, and I was able to see a psychologist for a little while and talk through what had happened, because I don't think it had really hit me, although it was you know, quite a long time after, towards the end of last year, it really, I don't think it had settled in, you know, and I don't think it had hit home exactly what I'm, and it really wasn't until I saw somebody that I realised what was going on around me. Fortunately, I've got a very loving and supporting family, no much more so than Avril, and you know, they've stood by me, they've helped me, you know, so throughout that, so I'm very, very lucky.
When he left the hospital, obviously, we're over the moon, you know, like, because we're saying that, I know, it'd be 18 months before he's back to his normal self, and it'd be like 6 months in hospital. So we were prepared for all that. And when he left within 4 weeks, we were absolutely over the moon. But we didn't just realise that we were then dealing with a brain injury. That was never really, it was mentioned, but it wasn't focused on. So we were unaware of just how different things would be. And it was simple tasks. You couldn't handle doing simple tasks. You were very confused, really frustrated.
So it's fair to say that those first few months of married life are very different from the ones that you had perhaps envisaged before the accident.
Yeah. I was just over the moon, delighted that it was home. But it wasn't until like a couple of weeks in that we started seeing that, okay, things are a lot different now. Yeah, but now you're a lot
more,
so you're getting back there.
Yeah, we're getting there. It's all positive now. It's nice because people, if you haven't met for a while, and they'll say to you, oh, you're so unlucky. And I just don't feel that way at all. I think I'm very lucky still to be here.
And now, in our final interview, we hear from Terry. She lost her husband, Brian, at the age of 35 when he tragically fell from the roof of a house 16 years ago. At the time, she decided to donate his organs. They went to 4 people. One of those was Jeff, who received Brian's kidney and pancreas. It formed a friendship that has lasted a lifetime, and when he needed another kidney, it took her seconds to make him an offer. Terry from Florida in the US spoke to our reporter, Lucy Bryant, to tell us more.
Husband Brian, who was a roofer, really sadly lost his life in the tragic fall from a house that he was working on. I can't imagine how horrible that must have been for you. And then to decide, you decided that you were going to donate his organs. How did you sort of come to that decision?
That was a decision that was actually already made by my husband before we even got to that point. And stuff, it was just something that we were definitely going to consider if something should happen.
And when you decided once he'd passed to donate the organs, did you sort of sit with him before he went in for surgery and just reassure him that he wasn't going to be forgotten?
Well, he basically never woke up, but I kind of had my last say, and he never did say anything back, so I guess I had the last say. but basically just talked to him that I would take care of the kids and help keep his memory alive for them.
Absolutely. Brian's organs actually went on to save the lives of 4 people in the end, which is incredible. Do you mind just telling sort of what organs it was that he donated and who those went to?
He donated his heart, lungs, kidneys, pancreas, and liver. His heart went to a gentleman we didn't ever get to meet. He was his heart and right kidney. And then his lungs went to Mary Jo. She lives in Nebraska. And then his pancreas and left kidney went to Jeff. And then his liver went to Howard, who lived in North Carolina at the time.
Oh, so amazing that you, because am I right in saying that for a year after the transplant, you weren't allowed to know exactly who'd received Brian's sort of organs, but you were able to exchange anonymous notes and letters just to sort of keep in touch with them. Is that right?
Yeah, we knew their first name and that was about it. My sister-in-law wrote to them first just because I was going through a little bit more of the grieving aspect of stuff. So I wrote to them about a year later and just kind of told them everything about me and the kids and what we were doing and how everything ended up going. All of them were like somebody had to die in order to for them to live. And I tried to tell them, I said, well, yes, that's the case, but somebody was going to die anyhow. They just chose not to take everything to the grave with them.
You went on to form such a tight friendship with Jeff and his family, didn't you?
Yes, he ended up coming over. We had the whole family there, and so we would meet. So we got to get to know the kids and played basketball with them and stuff. But because my immediate family lives in Orlando, I'd have to pass Tallahassee in order to go to Orlando. So usually every time we would drive to Orlando, I would say, hey, Jeff, you want to meet for breakfast or lunch or something? And we would meet on the side of the road or at a restaurant or whatever. Or there's several times that I would spend the weekend over at his house. And I like Florida State football and he doesn't, and he happens to live there. So anytime I would go to a game, I would say, hey, can I stay at your house?
Amazing. Good to have friends in handy places, hey?
Oh, yes, very much so.
And with the boys as well, obviously they'd lost a huge part of their life in losing their dad, especially at such a young age. So for you, when, do you mind telling us a bit about the time when Peyton sort of met Jeff?
So we were just spending time with Jeff at his house and stuff like that. And Peyton would reach over and put his hand on his stomach. He said, my dad's in there? And he go, and Jeff said, yes. You know, he goes, I'm going to keep him as long as I can. But, you know, Peyton has, because he was so young, they were always a part of our life.
So obviously the years went by and you had said to Jeff that, Jeff had said that he wanted to keep that part of their dad alive for as long as he could. But obviously it got to the point where Jeff broke the news to you that the kidney from Brian had actually failed. Was that a hard moment for you to realise that actually there was another part of him that had sort of died in a way?
It was like losing him all over again. But I had already started to think about becoming a living donor. And I'm like, well, that's weird that it just ended up being that that's what I was thinking about doing. And here he is. He needs a kidney. Yeah. So we had talked about it before, but then nothing came to fruition of it or anything. And then he posted it on Facebook. I'm like, hello, what part of I was going to give you a new kidney did you not get? And he goes, I didn't really think you were serious. And I'm like, well, yeah, I'm pretty serious.
How did he react when you said, actually, I want to do this for you?
Oh, he was pretty appalled, not appalled, but like just in shock that I would even consider it. And I said, well, I was going to do it for a stranger, so might as well be for somebody that already has, is already part of the family. So
absolutely. And obviously there's not always a guarantee that you'll be a match and that your kidney would be suitable.
But no.
It was a couple of months later, wasn't it, that you found out, in fact, that you were a perfect match. Was that a really special moment for you?
Oh, yeah, that was. I actually called him up and told and asked him if he was ready for a piece of me.
Oh, that's brilliant. And
he's like, sure.
Yeah, I'm sure he was over the moon because obviously for him, that is something to turn his life around all over again. And amazing that for you to know that a part of Brian and a part of yourself were going to be sort of side by side again, because obviously his pancreas is still, Jeff still got. So that's incredible.
Yes. Yeah.
And how?
In fact, my kidney wouldn't fit anywhere except beside Brian's kidney. So Brian's kidney is still there; it's just not working. But my kidney is the only place it would fit was right beside it.
That is so special. Is that a bizarre thing to think about?
It really is. It's like here you have a husband and a wife that are back together, and another man helping him live. And then it's just to give life of something that's just hard to put into words and how to, like, I don't know. It's a special feeling knowing that you've given somebody life.
It really is unbelievably incredible and selfless, and just something that I'm sure you would encourage other people to do if they can.
Oh, yes. Especially if you're healthy enough and you have something that, you know, that somebody else can extend their life. It's like, why not? I mean, I would give anything to have my husband back. I'm sure anybody, you know, that's on the waiting list, they would give anything just to have more time.
That was such a lovely story. And that's it for this week. Thank you to all of our guests for sharing their stories with us. If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, you can find all these stories and more on our Facebook page, Real Fix, or on www.real-fix.com. We would love it if you could leave us a review on your podcast app, and remember to subscribe while you're there. Thanks for listening. See you next time.